Zubaydah and Mansour collaborated for quite a number of years in trying to create some sort of an acceptable alternative to the unacceptable National Front, and try to build support of the same type of educated and intellectual people that the National Front is in the future. Mm-hmm. And they used to meet in the house next to mine, and I would sit in my house once in a while with them. And Hoveda really was the intellectual force behind it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so was the punchman. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The both of them got to be prime ministers eventually, and both met a sad end. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Indeed. Actually, I have a few more questions about your conditions in Tehran when you were stationed there. Where did you live in Tehran? In the north part of the city, or?
I lived in the north part of the city. I think I must have lived at an altitude of about 6,000 feet, whereas the city was about 4,500 feet. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, different climatic zone from Tehran, and overlooking the smog, mm-hmm. the way people live over there in the hills around Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Yes, I lived in the north part of the city.
Mm-hmm. And how much traveling around the country did you do when you lived in Iran?
I crisscrossed the country by uh-huh. every means of transportation, beginning from pedestrian to aircraft, jeep, horseback, motor, donkey. It was possible, fortunately, to really get into the country, and hence I think the general acceptance which I enjoyed, which really led to the situation where people began to forget that I was an American. In spite of cracks like the one you read about, having perhaps helped provoke those riots, or some cash guy said that I had introduced Sarah to some new method for dealing with sort of tongue-tied people who won't answer questions and so on. It's the Iranians who could teach us things like that rather than uh-huh. vice versa.
Now, those charges have been made over the years, the question of the CIA is rolling for writing.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
And some of them directed me personally. But that, of course, is all absolute nonsense. Though. Not the mission of our Secret Service, any more than it's the mission of MI6. Do things like that.
Did you acquire much in the way of Farsi speaking skills when you?
Quite a bit, but I not the fluency that some of my officers had, mm-hmm. but I could talk peasant vacation at hand. I lived among the tribes, and I had complete access all over the country, even in areas that were sort of military, special military zones, as the tribal zones, the Kashgar and the Bastardi tribes, considered delicate and subject to possible subversion from outside, but the Shah gave me free hand. Mm-hmm.
You said your officers had fairly good Farsi skills. Did they get training in Washington or when they arrived in the country?
Mm-hmm. No, they were specifically prepared. I suspect that the reason I was rushed out just because it was necessary to have someone to deal with the Shah. And since I already had some experience dealing with other kings, so I think I would pick, and also my general background with Turkey and Balkans and so on, I had an affinity for them, and an understanding of them there.
You said you were having rushed out in 57?
Well,
relatively?
Yes, relatively.
Well, is it usually people get more background briefings and so forth before they arrive?
Yes. Yeah. And more language preparation.
This is even true for station chiefs, as well as officers.
Well, less true of station chiefs. Uh-huh. We try to put the job of station chiefs too.
But back to the period in the mid-60s here in Washington, you would read the cable traffic coming from Tehran,
I would see as much of that as I wanted to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You were satisfied that the agency, the station and its offices were keeping tabs on internal political developments? And
yes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I thought we had some buffer. How many miles are out of reach for the bus is going to happen? MacArthur, he said there was no curious homes. A lot of people. There was a change I have to be the quality of the ambassadors, but perhaps the character of the ambassadors in the center. Whether Iran was considered to be sufficiently safely in the bag not to venture first class talent there, or perhaps it had not been safe.
But that could have been the assumption when certain people were chosen to be ambassadors?
I think possibly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would have a suspicion of that.
Well, there's more complacency about the prospects for the future.
Right.
Therefore, you don't have to send a home. You made periodic visits to Iran after 63?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And you met Meyer?
Yes. But after 63, I was mostly in Iranian circles. When I went back.
I'm not sure if I follow. Are there any struggles here?
I didn't get involved with our embassy very much.
Okay.
In that sense. Okay. I had my circle of Iranian friends and contacts and so on.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. I see. Now, one Foreign Service officer who worked on Iran during the 1970s suggested that after about 68, when Meyer was ambassador, it became unspoken policy at the embassy to curtail reporting that was critical of the Shah in any profound way. Does that ring true, or?
Yes. Definitely.
Any particular incident?
I can't think of any particular incident, but I think it was based on the hope of sort of maintaining a happy relationship with him, and making no waves.
But in general, though, during this period, the late 60s, did you take it for granted that Iran was on a fairly stable stable course of development?
Yes, I took it for granted that Iran was on a fairly stable course, although there were the usual mutterings about a great deal of general dissatisfaction and increasing concern about corruption, which really seemed to be seem to be getting worse, and the character of the people who are surrounding the Shah in his personal social life as well as his business life. Many Iranians felt that nobody dared present him with a piece of information that he might not like. The rush was to come up with things that would please him, which would result in a pat on the head or a good boy, and everything would be happy. And there were many Iranians who were important Iranians who realized that there was a great danger in this. The withholding of information. I think a lot of information is probably withheld by Sabak, and certainly by people like the chief of the supreme staff, the sort of head of the joint chiefs of staff, the Iranian armed forces, and people like that. And all of that's withheld information that might lead to unpleasantness.
They were just fearful of disturbing the Shah's frame of mind.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Which gave him a feeling of a kind of security, a kind of a false security. And yet he sort of suspected all the time that perhaps we were not. And his sincere and loyal friends that we claimed to be. And that's when he started to buy military equipment from the Soviet Union. He started with motor vehicles.
And then it
finished. He shifted to some small anti-aircraft cannon, I think, anti-aircraft artillery, and I don't know what else.
Of course, this all dates from the mid-60s, right? This, I think the military vehicles deal was made in 65 or 66.
I think probably about 66 when the vehicles started, and some of the old weaponry came in. And of course that gas pipeline deal was a big thing.
The steel mill for a gas pipeline.
Which made him to feel that he would enjoy great credits from the Soviet Union, not realizing that they were palming off on him something with a sort of 1920s technology in the 1960s.
It was not really a low-cost operation.
Absolutely.
Did this deal, the steel mill for a natural gas, did this elicit much criticism in Washington? Apart from the economics.
In Washington, yes.
I think I read that there was some effort to dissuade the Shah not to go ahead with the steel mill. The embassy or others made some efforts on that one.
I think we did in the embassy, but he said that his line was that Iran is advancing, it has to be independent. India has steel mill. To be a country of any significance, you have to have a steel mill.
From sort of an economic nationalist perspective.
Yes, precisely. Grandeur of the Persian Empire that he was hoping to restore.
A few minutes ago you mentioned that it was your sense that economic corruption was getting worse in the country, and you heard many reports along those lines. Was this in the late 60s?
Yes.
Okay. That you were living this?
Late 60s and 70s.
Right. I think you said earlier you retired from the government in 1969?
Yes.
And you kept up your connections with Iran in the following years?
I worked in Iran after that.
In what capacity?
As a promoter to put together sort of international consortium of major civil engineering projects, and reinsurance and
these big projects.
Shipping. Iran had a requirement for grain at a time when they were still getting subsidized grain from us, and so I became involved in that, and that allowed me to keep in touch with the Waunakee and key personalities, old friends and new ones. And
so you went back to Iran in 59, or was it a year or so later? Or?
I went back to Iran in 1970, I think. It was in 1970, and when I arrived at the foot of the steps leading up to the airplane, was a car from the palace to receive me, and then take me to my hotel. A very nice reception. So I'll say that I was always welcome in Iran, you know, that kind of thing.
How long did you stay in the country at that time?
Oh, these were all trips of 10 days.
You actually had settled down in
Russia. No,
I thought you said you moved there.
No, I was in Washington. And I think the last time I was there might have been, what, maybe 77?
So you made periodic business trips, basically.
Yes.
But you were doing Iranian business up through 77?
Probably about three times a year, maybe.
Did you maintain contacts at the embassy during those years?
Yes. I always called in the ambassador when I came, and I dealt with the economic counselor. And
William Lakefield, did you?
Yes, Bill. And the political counselor. But there wasn't really much that the embassy could do for me. I put better contacts on the embassy, in a sense, but more done for myself.
When you had your own lines of communication.
Right.
What were your impressions of political and social conditions in Iran during the 70s? For example, how stable did you think the situation was?
It looked stable, but there was more talk among my personal friends about dissatisfaction than there was when I left after being in Iran on duty. In the late 70s, there was more talk among kind of friends that I had who would not have talked this way further, but who were obviously beginning to sense things.
What were some of the issues that led to dissatisfaction? The question of corruption, I suppose, was that one?
That, I think, was almost foremost. And favoritism to court hangers-on and relatives. And the unbridled activity of the twin sister and her eldest son, Chakram, was very active in the business world. Yeah. And he actually came to see me one day. Maybe to help him in any way. Well, he was a major 5% of
the system.
Yes.
Did the officials of the embassy have much concern about these questions? Did they understand the dimensions of dissatisfaction with the dynasty among the upper middle class people that you knew?
I would say that they certainly didn't talk about it much. It was not a major topic of conversation in meeting all the embassy programs.
Even with Richard Helms, for example, did he sense that there was a problem? Or?
I think Helms perhaps did talk a little bit about that more than the others. But I think by the time Helms got out there, the system was so evolved in the state of now that even Helms was a bit sort of limited by it, I think.
He limited in his speed of action to say
yes,
to question
yes, right.
to question policy.
Yes, I think.
And you met the Shah during the course of the '70s, on occasion.
Yes.
How much had he changed since the years when you first met him, if he had changed at all?
I think he was a little bit grander. I think. But very pleasant. Of course, when I finally saw him in Mexico, he was broken then, but during that period when they were 75, so seemed to be. In retrospect, I think he was worried, but at the time I didn't sense that very much. It's so easy to get feelings in retrospect, and a little hard to keep those from the feelings you actually had at the time.
Retrospectively, looking back, what did you see in the Shah that sort of led you to think now that there were some, that he thought there were some problems, or what he was apprehensive in some ways? What were the signals that you picked up? I think you can pin them down.
It's difficult to pin them down. Yeah. It's his actions, really, sort of a more SABAC repression and interference than there had ever been before, I think. I think that was one sign. And then
he was uneasy about that in some ways, or
no? He found it necessary
to
tolerate it,
uh-huh, uh-huh.
or to require it.
Uh-huh.
And his sort of seeming enough concern about military people to have relative nonentities in command spots where he could keep his finger on them, afraid of some action by them.
If he had capable people in those positions.
Yeah.
So that was a sign of his insecurity, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't think I have any further questions. Do you have any concluding comments that you'd like to make?
Just as a matter of historical interest, I think that the Shah made tremendous advances. He pushed the country into the 20th century vigorously and quite successfully, but eventually lost it all through being undermined by personal weaknesses, which led to the selection of a collection of sycophants around him, a failure to select people of top quality for command positions, to people to whom he could delegate authority, and in this way, he let the whole thing slip out of his hands. Mm-hmm.
Actually, I have one question.
Yes.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that you saw the Shah in Mexico after he'd been deposed. What were the circumstances of that meeting?
I just asked if I may come down and see him.
Mm-hmm.
He said yes, by all means. He was an old friend. He received me very, very warmly, he and the Queen. And I think he sort of regards me as a, or regarded me as a sort of personal friend of the Pahlavi family, because I literally knew all members of the family, and some of them would come to the house quite often, and then that sort of thing. Not sure the Shah doesn't visit people's home, but the various princes, they've been often around my place, so I had a kind of a nice entree with him, and I knew that he was in some distress in Mexico. Just went down to have a chat.
Mm-hmm. Did he make any comments about the U.S. role, or about the U.S. role in the revolution of 78, 79?
He said that he just couldn't understand why we brought that about. He feels that we could have helped him stop it if we chose. He had some sort of serious misgivings about General Heiser's visit to Iran, which he said was a total mystery to him. Said that Heiser didn't have the courtesy to call on him first when he came to Iran to tell him that he'd arrived and tell him what his mission is, as would have been polite in the case of any senior official coming to Iran, and he feels that somehow we restrained the military forces from taking a kind of harsh, decisive action that might have knocked this whole thing on the head.
He thought that.
But he felt that also Britain had a role in this, and France, and he just couldn't understand why, what we got out of it. Well, as you know, all the Indians blame everything on foreign maneuvers, and so that is it. And the Queen felt the same way. So, from that point of view, that part of the visit wasn't a very happy one, being criticized for encouraging this.
No.
There was a time the Crown Prince, now the young pretender to the throne, had learned to fly a helicopter here when he was a bit undergoing Air Force training. And he wanted to give his parents a thrill by flying over the villa that he rented in Cuernavaca, and not telling anybody in advance. He was flying quite low, and the Mexican guards, which he employed, all started shooting at it with their submachine guns and so on, thinking that it was somebody bent on an evil mission.
Now, it's my last question. And in a recent book, James Bill proposes that U.S. policy in Iran during the post-war era was a combination of an intelligence and a policy failure. For example, he argues that because Washington considered the Shah to be indispensable and invulnerable, American officials stationed in Iran generally were not disposed to send in reports that were critical of the Shah or Iran. And this tendency to downplay bad news about the Shah in Iran reinforced the view in Washington that the Shah was invulnerable, which in turn strengthened the tendency to downplay the regime's weaknesses by officials in Tehran. Now, how much validity do you see in this analysis of a combination of a policy and intelligence failure.
Of course, any event that occurs unexpectedly reflects an intelligence failure. There's no doubt about that. But at the time that I was in Iran, at no time was I conscious of any efforts to either suppress or to downplay unfavorable information or unfavorable incidents. At that time, I felt that we had a useful interest in Iran from the point of view of American interests, and we tried to develop our relationships accordingly in order to promote our interests as we saw it then. But there certainly was no effort to keep from Washington such unfavorable information as we had about the royal family itself, any of the key personalities in government, mm-hmm. or the general course of events in Iran. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Of course, it may well have changed in the following years.
Could well have changed in the following years for purposes which at that time perhaps seemed like valid short-term interests. Mm-hmm. But that certainly was after my time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, no further questions. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope this was useful to you in some way. This happened quite a long time ago, so memory of detailed events isn't as clear as it would have been if we had had our conversation 10 years ago.
Okay. Thank you.